Welcome to the summit. Today we have Raymond Broomhall, barrister at law in Australian Tasmania, join us for part two of this compelling, empowering, really transformative discussion. And you need to see part one if you haven't seen it already. So Raymond, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through step by step, raise three page, I believe it's 22 points on this steps to remedy document that he has, walking us through his legal process. So this is hugely exciting. Ray, thank you for offering this to everyone for free, pro bono. I just want to take a moment and honor you and your intention in doing so. Like I said in the previous talk, your hourly rate is $400 an hour, and you've put hundreds of hours into this process. So thank you so much for offering it for free. May you be compensated richly, financially, and in all other areas that matter. Let's dive into this process. We're looking at the document that Ray has prepared called Non-Ionizing Electromagnetic Radiation, Steps to Remedy, and point number one. Ray, please, if there's anything you want to say about the process overall before starting, please do so, and then we'll dive into each one of these point by point.
Yeah, so basically what this is really, it's about establishing evidence, putting notice out, and preparing for litigation. So that's really what this is about. This is preparing, okay, and giving you a little bit of an insight as to what direction it might take if you wish to go down that road.
Now, if somebody's looking at this and they're wondering, I don't know if I want to litigate, can they still take the initial steps and then decide later?
Yeah, it's very much so. That's what this is about. So it's just basically getting evidence together, putting the carriers or the emitters on notice. And that's basically that's really what it's doing, really, in essence.
Excellent. So what we're looking at here, again, is the process that Ray has used with colleagues and with people in communities to reverse 1,600 planned deployments of small cells throughout Australia and to uninstall remove 900 additional small cell sites. So this is a process that is very, very strongly indicating as being effective. Ray, please dive in, and we'll go through this document as efficiently as we can here in this conversation.
Certainly. Okay, well, step one would be, first of all, common sense would be to identify the source of non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation, or the proposed emissions. Where is it coming from? Is it a mobile phone base station? Is it a communications tower? Is it a 5G small cell facility? Is it a smart meter? Is a Wi-Fi router, it could be in schools, for example, it could be your neighbour, etc. So, or any other device. So really just identify which area, what device you want to target, okay? Two, then you just got to identify the site where the emissions or proposed emissions will be radiated from. So for example, is it upon your home, your workplace, your school, hospital, retirement home, public transport, etc. Then the third thing is measure and record the distance between you and the ER emission device and or facility. Okay, now that's important because you need to know the actual distance that you are from the particular tower, and you can look at various reports to find out the actual pitch per meter or the it's very important to get that.
Okay, now for point three, it says, measure and record. What devices would you recommend people can use to measure and record, make measurements and then record the distance?
Google Earth's a very good tool to use. So you just use the measurement device from your Google Earth. So you identify, okay, the tower could be a kilometer away, it could be 500 meters away, it could be just next door. So you could just use a simple tape measure. But you basically need to know what the distance is. Four, identify the emitter or the proposed emitter, the installer, public relations, local council, and the landowner. Names of involved corporations and their respective ABN numbers, and also include the names of directors of such corporations. Now, the reason we do this is because we're actually identifying who's liable. So in essence, this is the people that we're targeting, okay?
So who are those people? What types of, let's just identify who someone would send to.
Okay, it'd be someone like you'll find if you go to a pole where they've got a little notice there saying that we're going to build a tower here or something like that, or put a small cell facility. It'll have a name of who the public relations company is, who you've got to contact. Well, they're all part of the process. So you need to identify them. They're usually acting as an agent for a major telecommunications company, so you need to include the telecommunications company. And we need to find things like their addresses, who they are, where they are, etc.
So you want to send to the address for the head, like the headquarters of like a Verizon, yeah, or is the carrier, yeah, right?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. And usually if it's a corporation in Australia, for example, we have to have what's called an Australian company number, and we need to find out what that number is. And you can go and look at the corporation's facilities, such as in Australia, we have the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, where you can actually do some searches there. In other countries, you'd have a different setup, but basically, it's just anything that identifies who the parties are who are joining forces to irradiate against you. And that's really what it's about. So in Australia, which is step five, now I'm not sure what it would be for any other country, but I assume they'd have a very similar setup. But in Australia, you can find your mobile communications tower on the RFNSA website at HTTPS. /www.rfnsa.com.au. School, hospital, putting the carriers or the emitters on notice, and that's basically that's really all it's doing, really, in mm-hmm. essence.
Excellent. So what we're looking at here, again, is the process that Ray has used with colleagues and with people in communities to dive into each one of the discussion, and you need to see part one. If you know, like I said in the previous talk, your hourly rate is $400 an hour, and you've put hundreds of hours. Thank you so much for offering it for free. May you be compensated richly, financially, and in all other areas that matter. Let's dive into this process. We're looking at the document that Ray has prepared called Non-Ionizing Electromagnetic Radiation: Steps to Remedy. And point number one, Ray, please, if there's anything you want to say about the process overall before starting, please do so, and then we'll dive into each one of these point by point.
Yeah, so basically what this is really, it's about establishing evidence, putting notice out, and preparing for litigation. So that's really what this is about. So it's preparing, okay, and giving you a little bit of an insight as to what direction it might take if you wish to go down that road.
Now, if somebody's looking at this and they're wondering, I don't know if I want to litigate, can they still take the initial steps and then decide later?
Yeah, yes, very much so. That's what this is about. So it's just basically getting evidence together, putting the carriers or the emitters on notice, and that's basically that's really all it's doing, really, in mm-hmm. essence.
Excellent. So what we're looking at here, again, is the process that Ray has used with colleagues and with people in communities to reverse 1,600 planned deployments of small cells throughout Australia and to uninstall remove 900 additional small cell sites. So this is a process that is very, very strongly indicating as being effective. Ray, please dive in, and we'll go through this document as efficiently as we can here in this conversation.
Certainly. Okay, well, step one would be, first of all, common sense would be to identify the source of non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation. All the proposed emissions, where is it coming from? Is it a mobile phone base station? Is it a communications tower? Is it a 5G small cell facility? Is it a smart meter? Is it a Wi-Fi router? It could be in schools, for example. It could be your neighbour, etc. So, or any other device. So really just identify which area, what device you want to target, okay? Two, then you just got to identify the site where the emissions or proposed emissions will be radiated from. So, for example, is it upon your home, your workplace, your school, hospital, retirement home, public transport, etc. Then the third thing is measure and record the distance between you and the ER emission device and or facility. Okay, now that's important because you need to know the actual distance that you are from the particular tower, and you can look at various reports to find out the actual pitch per meter or the it's very important to get that.
Okay, now for point three, it says measure and record. What devices would you recommend people can use to measure and record, make measurements and then record the distance?
Google Earth's a very good tool to use. So you just use the measurement device from your Google Earth. So you identify, okay, the tower could be a kilometre away, it could be 500 metres away, it could be just next door. So you can just use a simple tape measure. But you basically need to know what the distance is. Four, identify the emitter or the proposed emitter, the installer, public relations, local council, and the landowner. Names of involved corporations and their respective ABN numbers, and also include the names of directors of such corporations. Now, the reason we do this is because we're actually identifying who's liable. So, in essence, this is the people that we're targeting, okay?
So, who are those people? What types of, let's just identify who someone would send to.
Okay, it'd be someone like you'll find if you go to a poll where they've got a little notice there saying that we're going to build a tower here or something like that, or put a small cell facility. It'll have a name of who the public relations company is, who you've got to contact. Well, they're all part of the process. So you need to identify them. They're usually acting as an agent for a major telecommunications company, so you need to include the telecommunications company. And we need to find things like their addresses, who they are, where they are, etc.
So, so you want to send to the address for the head, like the headquarters of like a Verizon, yeah, or
yes,
whatever yes, is the carrier,
yeah,
right?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. And usually if it's a corporation in Australia, for example, we have to have what's called an Australian company number, and we need to find out what that number is. And you can go and look at the corporation's facilities, such as in Australia, we have the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, where you can actually do some searches there. In other countries, you'd have a different setup, but basically, it's just anything that identifies who the parties are who are joining forces to irradiate against you. And that's really what it's about. So in Australia, which is step five, now I'm not sure what it would be for any other country, but I assume they'd have a very similar setup. But in Australia, you can find your mobile communications tower on the RFNSA website at HTTPS. /www.rfnsa.com.au. And once you get onto that site, you type in your suburb, identify the tower, click on it, and retrieve the EME report and the compliance certificate. Now, the EME report is what's known as the electromagnetic energy report, and in that it will have the particular exposure levels and limits that are coming from that particular device. And you can, and it actually has the measurements, so it'll tell you if it's 100 metres away what the volts per metre will be, if it's 200 metres, 300, and so on.
Now, in the United States, I believe it's just limited to the United States. There's a website called antennasearch.com.
Okay.
Do you know anything about that website? Would that be where people in the United States would go?
I don't know. I haven't looked at that personally, but I assume okay, that... That sounds about right.
Okay, so we will we'll do some legwork on that and find out what the website is for United States, and we'll put that on the screen. So, please continue with the
okay. Then step six, is it an existing installation? So, if yes, most likely it has already been approved by council, or in the alternative, it did not require development approval. So I suggest that you contact the council to confirm that. Okay.
So when you say contact council, that's your local town or county council, is that correct?
Yes, yeah, so it'd be municipality council, your municipal council, it could be your local council, your local government, whoever looks after your bylaws and your rates and your sanitation, that sort of, usually that organisation. Yeah, whoever approves development applications for these things.
Now, is email fine, phone call, written letter? What type of methodology can people do?
Well, you can just usually a phone call is enough, sufficient, or you can email. It's really up to you how you communicate. But as long as you just want to find out, does it require, do they have to go get development approval for this particular facility? In a lot of cases they do, and in a lot of cases they don't, depending on the impact. Is it a high impact facility or a low impact facility? And usually if it's already on an existing tower, they don't need development approval. That's particularly here in Australia. So if you've got a 30 metre tower and they want to start putting extra antenna on there, they don't have to get development approval for that. If they want to put a small cell facility on an existing power pole, they don't have to get development application for that. So you need to find out what is going on. Okay?
Okay.
So, again, if it's a proposed installation, which means it hasn't even been installed yet and they're thinking of putting it up, and you've heard on the grapevine that's going to happen or you've seen some notices, first of all, you need to, does it require development approval? Again, you've got to contact your council. If the development approval is required, ask the council for an expiry date that any objection submissions are to be submitted by. Now, that's very important. So if the council tells you and says, yes, it does require a development approval, they'll give you an expiry date and you must get your warning notice, et cetera, a medical opinion, legal advice, et cetera, in by a particular date.
Okay.
Very important. Now, sometimes this is step eight, which is really a step, but sometimes the emitter or proposed emitter will advertise to the public requesting submissions inclusive of deadlines concerning their installation as part of an industry public consultation process. Now, verify whether their consultation process forms part of a legitimate council development application or not. Now, sometimes you'll find that the telecommunications companies will do a public consultation just as a spin. They don't actually have to do it, but they just do it to find out what's out there and what's are there going to be any complaints against their development, even though they don't have to get development approval. So it's really their way of toying out to see what the opposition is going to be like, but still take advantage of that process. Is what I'm suggesting.
Yeah. And now, how would someone specifically verify that? Would they ask their local town council?
Yes, that's correct. Yes. Yeah. Or even themselves. You say, is this going for a formal development application process, or is it just really you're doing the right thing by doing a public consultation process with us? Yeah, that's basically what you do. Yes. Okay, nine. If the emitter, the proposed emitter, has been in contact with you via letter, notice, etc., then collate all correspondence, including all correspondence you may have sent to the emitter also. Now, that's extremely crucial. So in order for a lawyer to work this out for you, and you can get any lawyer to do this, you don't have to get me, you can get any lawyer. But basically, what you need to do is put it together, get all your evidence. It's crucial because you don't know what you've said, you don't know what the emitters said. The lawyers need to know exactly what has been communicated between the two. Mm-hmm. Okay, very, very important.
So it says if the emitter, proposed emitter, has been in contact with you, what if other parties involved?
Exactly.
Regulators or anything? Yeah.
Yeah, regulators, you might have written to, for example, US, the FCCC, or in Australia, you've written to a PANZA or whoever it might be, ACMA, any regulatory authority, even if it's to a minister, and you've sort of done a lot of precursor stuff about making an initial complaint. Any correspondence that you've sent out, it's crucial that you put all that together.
Okay, so have a folder and yes. just put everything in it, and then at the appropriate time, you're going to use that and use a copy of all of that correspondence.
And the other thing too is diary entries are very important too. They are considered to be prime evidence. So anything, you know, if you're having a telephone conversation, just write it in your diary and get copies of that and get that to your lawyer as well. I think that's important.
Excellent.
Okay, step 10, and this is probably the most important part of the lot, is obtain a medical opinion as to whether or not the EMR emissions or proposed emissions are or could pose a risk of harm to your health. If risk of harm to health is advised, then request that the medical practitioner advise on recommendations as to what needs to be done to remedy the situation. Examples of recommendations might be that you are not to be exposed to EMR emissions from the tower or device, etc., to use cable instead of Wi-Fi, to turn routers off, etc. To assist, you may wish to provide your medical practitioner with a link to the Bioinitiative Report 2012, which is updated 2017, and it's called A Rationale for Biologically Based Public Exposure Standards for Electromagnetic Fields, ELF and RF, and you can find that at the link at bioinitiative.org/. And the following link to Physicians for Safe Technology, 5G mobile communications, and you can find that link at ndsafe.org. You can also ask your doctor to refer you to a specialist medical practitioner who consults EMR patients on a regular basis, and even better, one who has appeared in either a court or tribunal on EMR issues. Your lawyer may be able to refer you to a medical specialist if needed. And please note, attached to two samples of medical opinions that may assist your medical practitioner. So I provided those if you wanted to take those to your doctor to have a look, to get an idea of how other doctors have put them together. The one that you're seeing is obviously a specialist in EMR, so that might assist.
Okay, so let's talk about this. This is a big part of the process, step 10. Mm-hmm. So how... Okay, so the first step is for someone to make an appointment with their doctor, whether it's a, you know, medical doctor or a naturopathic doctor or, you know, whoever their primary health care provider is, correct?
Yes, I'd prefer if you had an actual medical doctor.
Okay.
So someone that's recognized as a authorized medical practitioner and who's you can get integrative practitioners who obviously practice mainstream medicine, but also do the integrative approach where they actually use not necessarily mainstream sources, but the issue is that they've got to be a medically qualified doctor.
Okay, so perhaps, and before that appointment, you're saying that you would email your doctor those two links, the bioinitiative.org and the mdsafe.org, and if there's any other information you want to tag on to that, correct?
Yeah, don't overload them because you might find that they could get a bit too much. I mean, there's a lot of science out there talking about potential risk to harm, etc., and you know there are a lot of studies, but the Bioinitiative report seems to be a lot more concentrated. There's thousands of studies in that particular document, but also the ndsafe.org, which is the Physicians for Safe Technology, that's actually doctors that have all got together. I think that's a US site too, by the way, so they might be able to assist there, and they will have doctors there that you can talk to and possibly get some advice from.
Okay. Now, so you make an appointment with your doctor, you send your doctor these couple links in advance and other info. And then you have your appointment with your doctor. You talk about your concerns and what happens if they look at those, you know, sample letters or whatever, and they're not, if your doctor is not willing, Raymond, to sign a letter or to do what you need them to do. How do you handle that?
Well, you could always ask the doctor to give you a referral to someone that does specialise in it. and you could maybe give them a suggestion as to some of the doctors that are known in house, you know, that are known that do these sorts of advices. So ask for that referral. If that doesn't work, then maybe go and see another doctor or contact some of your local EMR groups, 5G groups, whoever it might be, and they might be able to assist you on some of the medical practitioners out there.
And I was thinking, contact your local building biologist, right? Go to the building biology website, find out who's local, contact them, and then they might, you know.
Yeah, they're very helpful. You'll find building biologists are right into this, and they obviously provide a lot of shielding, etc., and obviously do testing of your property to see if what the emissions are. Yes, they would be able to assist there, I would say, as well, and the more networking you can do, the better. But once you find a doctor that's actually willing to do this, they usually like gold.
Yeah. Okay. Now, would you recommend when somebody goes to that appointment for to their doctor, their first appointment, right? Should they bring a printed out, already customized letter for their doctor to sign, or should they just bring the sample letter and have their doctor sort of, you know, fill it out?
Yeah, what the sample letters I'm giving you are extremely detailed, and there's a lot in it. And I guess what it's designed to sort of educate the doctor a bit when they see it. So it's all in medical. I mean, these particular advices that you're seeing were actually presented. And you'll notice that one of them is specifically for this doctor had two other doctors who are his clients, and you'll see quite clearly that it's designed for doctors to interpret. And that's what they're for.
Okay.
So it's sort of an educational tool, really.
Okay, yes. So how about this then, Ray? Before the appointment, somebody sends those two links, and if there's any other info, and an attached copy, an editable, like, Word document copy of one of these sample letters.
Yes. I think that would be, that might assist in some way. Yes.
Okay, good.
But I can't tell a doctor how to diagnose or treat or whatever. That's up to them. But it's just to let them see that there are other doctors out there that are prepared to come out to explain the situation.
Excellent.
And I might also give you a simple medical advice as well, because I think it might overwhelm a doctor to follow what I'm giving you. So I'll give you a very simple one, which just has the very basic saying, in my opinion, I think that this person, their fear is reasonable, that I don't believe it's safe, and I recommend that don't get exposed to it. Now, you know, it's just something simple like that is enough. Step number 11 then would be, if the EMR emissions are from an existing installation, obtain witnesses who have mobile cell or internet coverage in your home. So, for example, when they visit your home, do the witnesses have reception from their carrier? If yes, reception indicates that your home is being irradiated by their carrier, and witnesses can swear or affirm their testimony as evidence in an affidavit format or a statutory declaration. And you'll need to see a lawyer in regards to putting one of those together. Mm-hmm. But that's an important thing. So getting evidence from an independent person, not from yourself, but somebody independent that can say, yes, I've gone to your home, I've got this particular carrier, there's bars on my phone, they're clearly irradiating your home, I can see it on my phone. And then you just get them to testify in writing that that's what's going on.
Okay, now, is one such witness sufficient, or would you recommend two affidavits?
Oh, well, as many as you can get.
Yeah.
I think they've got to be people who are prepared to attend court to give evidence that they came to your home and they looked on their phone, and yes, there was, my carrier is such and such, and I've got it all on my. I've got my laptop, and I'm getting coverage from my internet provider. Here it is. Yes.
Okay. So one affidavit from one witness is sufficient, but two is maybe preferred. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, two, three.
Three. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. The more the merrier, actually. That's good. The other thing is then step 12 is contact the building biologist to conduct a report as to the level of EMR emissions in your home. Now, that's pretty important, because what you're doing there is basically working out what the ambient or the current levels of electromagnetic radiation or exposure that you've been exposed to at that, the current time. And then if they then decide to, or everything fails and they then decide to put something up and you can then go and measure it, then you can sort of see that there is a clear difference between the electromagnetic radiation. But not only that, the emissions that a biologist can look at, we then also refer it to the EME report, which indicates what the proposed emissions will be from that electromagnetic energy report that's been provided by the provider. And we can sort of assess exactly how much increase of dosage that you're going to be exposed to. So that's important.
So everyone can look up the website for Building Biology Institute, find a local rep, or contact the company, the organization, if there's no local reps, right? And
yes.
So what about if somebody, you know, either can't afford to bring in a building biologist? They're, you know, some of them are fairly economical, not too expensive, but if someone still is in a position to not do that, can they take those readings of EMR, those measurements themselves?
Well, they could, but it all comes down to how persuasive that evidence actually is. It's best to have an independent person do it, which in essence that person will be an expert and they'll be considered an expert witness. But if you did it yourself, you wouldn't be. So the reliability of your evidence wouldn't be exactly strong if you wanted to take that to court.
Okay.
But it would help. It would help, but it wouldn't be very strong. We'd already have the proposed emissions anyway from the EME reports. That'll tell us what's there. But as I said to you before, sometimes the industry, to ensure that they're being regulated, it'd be nice to measure it independently. So that's basically what that's about. Number 13, this is an interesting one, is obtain quotes for shielding purposes, such as shielding mesh, clothing, shielding paint, etc., to shield not only your home, but also your house, inclusive of land. Now, a building biologist should be able to assist in this regard also, and this will provide evidence to claim compensation for damage to property, because how it works is if your home is being radiated, let's say they, for some reason you fail, you can't stop the telco, well, at least you can still take them to court and say, well, I need my home shielded to protect me from the contamination of the electromagnetic radiation that's on my property. This is how much it's going to cost. Now, the beautiful thing about that is it does two things as well. One, it gives you, sets you up for civil litigation, so you can get seek compensation if you try, if you could apply for compensation if you wish. But also, under certain environmental laws, it can be classed as a serious environmental nuisance, or if it goes over a certain dollar range. Now, in Australia, for example, if it goes over $50,000, it can be classed as serious. $5,000. As simple as that. $5,000. It is classed as serious. So, in essence, you can go through and have a look, work out what it is. Now, to give an idea, to build a large Faraday cage over entire property is going to cost a fair bit of money. So you can imagine how much if everybody started flooding in and saying, well, if you're going to build these towers, I want to be protected by shielding. That's where we go with possibly class actions, etc., possible independent civil litigation in the civil sphere. So that's pretty important to do that if you can. And it's just getting a quote. That's all we're asking.
Really?
That's not going to cost you anything, is it? It's just say, excuse me, building biologist, how much is it going to cost to shield my home? If you have the funds, you could also obtain, this is step number 14, an independent radiation dosimetry report as to radiation levels emitted from the device or facility and SAR levels entering yours or your children's body. Now, that's a specific absorption rate. And basically what you're doing there is measuring that. And that's, again, the pre and after. So you do that before any tower was built or anything like that. And then you could do another dosimetry report after the tower was built just to see exactly what the absorption rate is.
And if the tower's already up by the time you're doing this process, then obviously just having it at the time is sufficient, right?
Yes. As long as you've got something to indicate what's going on.
Okay.
Are you absorbing this stuff?
So that kind of report would include the power density.
Yes.
The measurements from the testing devices and also the specific frequencies?
Yeah, it works out the absorption rate. So how much is your body actually, how much electromagnetic radiation is your body actually absorbing?
Does a building biology certified professional do that kind of report as well?
You usually get a dosimetry expert to do that sort of work. You just have to look around, and you can even contact your regulators as to who does those, and you can even contact Department of Health just to find out who actually does those, and that's if you've got the funds, and you know, those sort of reports are usually quite expensive.
So optional, but again, it's sort of just a one step that this is all about making your case strong, legitimate, well documented, to basically put in the time and energy to go through these steps, do as many of them as you can to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
But this is still an optional step, right?
So the most important thing is just the medical certificate, basically a medical opinion and legal advice. The rest of it is only extra, if that makes sense. Getting witnesses for your affidavits in regards to the emissions into your home, that's important. But the rest of it, like the building biologist to get a quote, and not necessarily important, but it probably would assist you in the future if you wanted to. Now, once you've done that, step 15 is collate all your documents as mentioned above and forward copies of evidence to your lawyer or your attorney. Okay. And then what you do at 16 is instruct your lawyer or your attorney to draft an advice for you on their letterhead as to your legal position, your legal options, the legal remedies, chances of success, and the pitfalls, etc. The advice may include opinion as to remedy concerning laws that apply the precautionary principle. And as I explained here, the precautionary principle is an integral component in state or federal policy and is usually found embedded in the majority of state and federal legislation. And the precautionary principle, as a rule, should be actioned when an activity raises threats of harm to human health or the environment, and precautionary measures should be taken even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. Hence, so therefore, health risks associated with EMR, though not fully established scientifically at present, would still require precautionary measures to be taken by emitter and governmental decision makers. Okay, so that's sort of assisting not only you, but also if you wanted to show this to a lawyer, they'd understand where that's coming from. So that's why I put that in there.
And do you have any suggestions for how someone find a suitable lawyer or attorney?
Someone that's got a bit of an environmental law background and also a criminal law background. So you want to have somebody that's got that behind them, and somebody that's got some experience in doing restraint applications, such as domestic violence applications or apprehended violence applications, peace and good behaviour. They've got different names around the world, but that's basically what you're looking for. You know, keep the peace orders, those sorts of that. You know, people that deal with the magistrates' court.
Okay. Okay, and then a building biologist might also be able to recommend people in the environmental area as well as the...
Yeah, you can also contact your environmental defenders' offices. There's usually a lot of those around. You contact your community legal centres, they might be able to assist. Some of those centres do it for free, so it all depends on who you see. You can also contact disability advocacy organisations, they can also assist. So really this is a general assistance thing for lawyers out there. You just the trick is just go see your local lawyer and say, excuse me, you know, help.
Yeah, and what about having your lawyer watch this specific talk?
If they wanted to, yes. Yeah. I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you're contacting, when you're trying to, you know, establish a relationship with your lawyer, you're looking for the right one, would you suggest that people, like, get a price quote in advance? Is it find out an hourly rate? Find out...
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's important. So there's usually an ethical reason that they have to do that. They have to disclose what their rate is, how much it's going to cost, those sorts of things. So, and usually have a little thing called a cost agreement. You go through that process. You can get a quote. Just say, hey, look, I want this done. How much is it going to cost for you to do an advice for me? with me, I'm actually what's called a barrister. So a lot of lawyers will refer me to give an advice. It all depends on how you do it. So in most countries like, say, Canada, you'll find them in UK, Australia, Hong Kong, those sort of places. How it works is you'll have a solicitor who's your lawyer or your attorney, and then they'll brief what's called a barrister, which is someone like yourself, to do an actual advice. And when they say it's settled by counsel, that's what they're referring to. I'm not sure how it's done in the US, but I think you'll find that it's just you just get your advice from your lawyer or your attorney, and they might have I doubt there are very many specialist lawyers out there that deal with EMR, but you could. The basic principles are there, though. So as I said, it'll be things like assault principles, restraint applications, those sorts of things. Nuisance, if they're into nuisance law, that'd be very handy.
Yeah. Now, I just want to understand this point clearly, because are you receiving the advice, the document from your lawyer, and that's from them to you, or are they writing it specifically for you to send to the offending parties? Is that something else? Help us understand the specifics of it. And secondly, Ray, do you have like a template of this advice document example that you could include?
That's a toughie. I've got to be very careful. I don't want to, but that's an advice. So it's got a letterhead. This is my advice. Is a 28 pages long as a rule around that area.
Got it.
And, so they're very detailed and explain all the liabilities in there.
It's tough, because this is something that maybe you might not be comfortable putting out there as a template, right?
Well, the problem with that is that with this legal advice, they have to be specific for each. So this one here, for example, is just for Queensland only.
Okay.
So my other advices would be for New South Wales only, because they're all different. So each state has different laws, and that's where it gets complicated, because you've got to sort of fit in your legal opinion to suit each particular state. And if I gave something like this, it would just be a basic, I'll do what I can. I'll put something together just to give you a redacted version of what my advice would probably look like.
Okay.
And then, but it's not an advice. It's just an educational tool only, and someone would have to then tweak it to suit whatever. Use it as a bit of a some sort of educational tool, really. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Ray, and for your willingness to include a redacted version of that. Obviously, you know, it's pretty understandable. We all get why, you know, you would have to only include part of it, but thank you, that's helpful. And also, I just wanted to mention the link that's on this page. Now, that also is a very suitable organization for people to financially support, as you mentioned in part one of your talk, right? And secondly, they should be able to, we're hoping, if the documents are on the website, then yes, you can contact them and ask some specific questions, such as, you know, what do I do for my, you know, country or state or province or whatever. And so they will be able to provide like at least those initial questions. But at the same time, you guys, like, please support that organization, because, you know, we want the energy exchange to go both ways. So everyone, when you go to that website, specifically for the documents, templates, and guides, we may also, because we're all creating this in the moment, this is so timely, and it was just, you know, we're helping to move everything forward. Keep an eye out for, like, specific instructions. There might even be a specific instruction by that time for your country. So, Ray, please continue. If there's anything else you want to say about that point, or go to the next one.
Okay, sure. Once you've have your number 17 is once you have a legal advice, send the said advice and the medical advice to your counsel, and all parties such as the emitter, the installers, the landowners, inclusive of directors of the emitting companies involved. Attach a cover letter to your advices and call it an objection notice. Now, I've actually drafted something to assist. I've actually called a warning. warning and objection notice. That might assist in some way.
That's in the document and template pack, so that's provided, correct?
Yeah, so you just attach that put your legal advice to it. Your lawyer might want to change that, so this is just something to assist, but for educational purposes, but always see a lawyer before you start playing around with this sort of stuff as a rule. Now, attach a cover letter to your advisors and... in the objection notice, state that you do not consent to be irradiated with their EMR emissions and that you have established a reasonable belief and fear and or apprehension that the emissions pose a risk of harm to health and a risk of damage to your property, and then send that by registered mail. Hmm. Okay? I won't read all this out, but took a while for me to work this out and put it together, and it sort of covers everywhere, the warning and objection notice. Now, what you're going to understand too is that sometimes councils own the land where the tower is going to be built or the power pole is, or whatever. Now, the issue is that they're technically liable if they approve, if it's on their land. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, you also include them as part of it. Now, number 18.
You're sending that to the city council members as well, or just the council, the city as a whole, like as a corporate entity?
I'll do both. I'll send it to the council and to the councillors, because they're the ones that are going to vote on this. So, and they're the ones that are going to stir up. Well, basically. Say no, we want a moratorium, we don't want this built until there's been some more clarification as to more evidence that it's safe. We don't believe that there's enough science out there to indicate that it is safe, and we just want a moratorium to establish that it is safe, not the other way around.
Right, okay. So it's, again, the recipients of this process, the carrier, any regulator, such as the FCC or whomever is the regulator, whether it's a state or provincial or federal, correct?
Not so much the regulators, because...
Not so much, what you say, okay.
You're really going to the local level here. You don't really need to involve the regulator here. See, the councils have a lot of power, believe it or not. They can abate, and I will... It does explain it in here, but basically what a council can do is they can say, well, on health grounds or on nuisance grounds, we can, even though we've approved it last week, we've now come to the conclusion that this thing possibly is a risk of harm to health, we can then simply abate, which is basically means to stop, put a notice, a bit like if you've got weeds in your backyard and the council wants you to mow your lawn, it's similar to that. So if it's a risk to public health, then they can come around and do that. That's sort of how it works.
Okay, so are we sending that this step to the carriers, and if so, is it like the CEO or is it the legal department? Who is it addressed to?
Well, you usually send it to whoever is the PR person. They usually take over and say, well, look, this is and it's usually a separate company. They always do that. But you find out, okay, you just go straight to the top. I'd go straight to the head office and the CEO. I don't muck around. I don't who are the major directors of the company, and that's who I go for. Because they're the ones that are ultimately liable, because they're the decision makers.
To clarify that, in their individual capacity or in their capacity as an actor within that corporate, is it to the corporation or is it the individual capacity?
It's both. It's to the corporation itself and then to the individual. Yes.
Okay. And you can accomplish that simply by when you address and send on the... Do you have to do anything else specifically when you actually send?
You can send it specifically to the corporation, to such and such, because they're technically an entity. So they're a legal entity, the corporation. If you send it to a director, then it's still technically being sent to the company anyway. But when you send it to a company director... It also includes them in a personal liability issue as well. So just simply to a director and also to head office, and you should be fine.
So head office, legal attention, legal department, let's say, and also to the CEO.
No, you'll find that on, look for all the documentation to find out who it's to be sent to, because you'll find that a lot of corporations, for example, have about 20 or 30 different companies that they're all operating under. So you want to get to the crux, find out from your regulator who is actually responsible for this tower, who's responsible for this smart meter, who is it? Who actually is it? And then get confirmation from the company, okay, who is responsible for this thing? It takes a bit of legwork. If you could do it yourself, it'll save a lawyer doing a lot of running around, but that's basically what you do.
Okay, so let's say just on average, or the typical process could be to the head or whatever company is responsible, and secondly to like the CEO of the carrier. Is that like what?
Yeah, that's,
if we're going to standardize the process,
yeah, I'd go straight to the CEO. Where I'd go. So the chief executive officer or the director.
And then this piece, not to the regulators, but you also send it to the city. Or the county or local municipality,
whoever's in charge of the development side of things. So usually it's your local council. You go to them, and they, because they're really going to be the decision makers, because you want them to get the opportunity to look at it. And the more councils you make aware of it, the more they'll realise that okay, there is a concern, particularly here. We've got a doctor's report that says it is a concern, and with the reports that I've got where it says an extreme risk of harm, that should be taken lightly.
Now, if there's a local government with a mayor and 9 councillors, who do you send to? How many? All of them. Okay. So, like, the city, and then the mayor and the 9 councillors, if there's that many. Just send, they all get a copy.
Yep. Everyone gets a copy.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, because usually you'll notice that when you read the medical opinion, which you see the medical opinions, you'll see it actually explains all the science. It goes through all the studies and where it's found harm, and it's all there. So you want the counsellors to be educated, because a lot of them don't realise what this stuff does. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh my God, I didn't know that. It's an education process.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Right, now, so that's number 18. Then you lobby your councillors and your aldermen, okay, and send your objection notice to each councillor and alderman within the council, and try to meet with them to explain your situation. Now, councillors are usually pretty open to that sort of thing, and sometimes they even have public meetings to assist that, and they might even call the carrier to come in and have a chat. So try and encourage that if you can. 19, hopefully after receiving your objection notice, the emitters will tactfully withdraw from installing the facility, and or the council will issue an abatement notice against the emitters and or reject any development application. So that's hopefully where it sits, okay, up to that point. The next part of it is where they don't do that, okay? The council says, no, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to listen to the advice I've been given by you. See you later. The emitters do the same. That's where the next bit comes into it, okay? Do you want me to explain that?
Yep. Please.
Okay. So number 20 is, however, if the emitters and or council decide not to heed your objection notice and make it known to you by a response letter to your objection, and or by conduct, such as commence building and installing, that they intend to proceed with the installation or development, then you may have various legal options available to you. If such an intention to proceed is made known to you, and their intention to proceed cause you discomfort in the form of fear of harm that they'll irradiate you and your family, then such action would constitute a threat to assault. And in this particular case, under Section 75 of the Criminal Code Act 1899 Queensland, I've just put that in there just to give a bit of a reference. Now, 21. So the objection notice should provide the requisite evidence to enable you to apply various legal options and remedies. And in the state of Queensland, for example, options and remedies include, but are not limited to. So I've gone through and explained what you can do. Now, first one that can be done is what's called a civil side of it. You can do an abatement notice, which comes under environmental nuisance. You can do a personal injury claim for psychological injury. You can do damage to property claim because your home is uninhabitable, thus requires shielding. You can seek a mandatory injunction. Now, what a mandatory injunction is a court order to force the council to abate or to prosecute the emitters. Because the council have an obligation and a duty under their local government acts to abate if there's been an environmental nuisance or there's a possible damage to health or risk to health. Now, if they don't perform their civic duty to do that, you can seek what's called a mandatory injunction, usually in the Supreme Court. But you'll need to have a good talk to a lawyer about that. Okay.
Now, does that hinge on the accountability and the liability sort of built into
that's correct.
To elected officials to look after their constituents' health if a complaint is brought to them, yeah?
Exactly. And mandatory injunctions can also apply in the higher echelon, so with your ministers, with decision makers, etc. So it goes all the way up the ladder. And the people can, if it's unconscionable what's going on, there is an option that might be available to somebody to seek a mandatory injunction. Now, I'm not sure if they apply particularly in the United States, but they certainly do apply here. But you'll need to talk to a lawyer about that.
Good.
Okay. Okay. Number two is you can go into the quasi-criminal jurisdiction, and here you can apply for court-ordered restraint orders, such as peace and good behaviour orders, also known in other states and territories, this is in Australia, as protection orders and or apprehended violence orders or keep the peace orders. Now, this is it's not actually criminal yet. What a quasi-criminal means is that, look, someone's threatening to assault me. I could either get them charged under the criminal code, but I don't want to do that. I just want to get them to stop and keep the peace. So I go through a quasi-criminal side of things. That's what restraint orders are. The thing is, it's only a civil sort of remedy in a funny way. But if they breach it, if an order's being made against them to restrain, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to emit, you've got to stop emitting for 2 years, stop. If they breach that, then they've committed a criminal offence. And that's what that's for.
Wow, this is excellent.
Okay, now number three, okay? That's criminal. This is now the criminal jurisdiction. Now, in this case, you can then go for prosecution of various criminal offences for what's known as trespass against the person. And in essence, an assault is a trespass against my person. Exactly what the electromagnetic radiation is doing is trespassing against my person. That's what an assault is. Mm-hmm. So I've already explained before about assault, so I won't repeat that, but there's a section, it does talk about assault here. In this particular case, all you need is personal discomfort, and please note that threatening to apply force, such as electrical force, is considered unlawful, mm-hmm. and that it is not essential that a person threatened should be put in fear. An apprehension or expectation of assault is sufficient. Okay, so
this is a really important part of it, because that brings one's own perspective of one's own well-being, backed up by their doctor's opinion. It really brings it finally applicable. We finally have leverage in that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And if they don't listen to your advice and they go ahead and say, "Well, I'm blow you, I'm going to build this thing," and you see them starting to build it, well, they're technically threatening to assault you under the code. Okay. Yeah. So there's threatening violence, which is I won't go through it, but I've already explained that to you. But that also includes a 2-year imprisonment term. This is in Queensland. Mm-hmm. And if the offence is committed at night, the offender is liable to imprisonment for 5 years.
Wow.
Okay. Endangering life of children by exposure. Now, section 326 of the Criminal Code, any person who exposes a child under the age of 7 years, whereby the life of such child is or is likely to be endangered, or the child's health is or likely to be permanently injured, commits a crime, and there's a maximum penalty of 7 years imprisonment there. that you can have assault occasioning bodily harm. Now, in this particular case, I'll just read this very quickly. An assault causing any hysterical and nervous condition is an assault occasionally bodily harm.
Wow.
Okay?
That's significant.
That's significant. So you, now I've got a case here called R. and Miller, which is 1954, 2 Queen's Bench, 282. Now this is an English case that would apply in Australia and clearly would apply in the US, England, UK, I'm sorry. Now, another thing you've got to understand is this, is that bodily injury occurs if pain has lasted for a couple of days, then the body has suffered a damage as defined in Brown and Blake, 2000, Western Australian Supreme Court of Appeal, 132. So even there, if you've got pain, you go to your doctor, this thing's hurting me, I'm getting bad headaches, I'm getting tonight, you know, whatever it might be, then that's bodily injury, technically. Okay?
Yeah.
But the trick is, it might be a little bit iffy, but I think the trick is to go down certainly the hysterical and nervous condition side of it in regards to fear. I think that would apply very much so. Now, serious assault, which is section 340 of the Criminal Code, any person who commits an unlawful assault on a person who is 60 years of age or more and assaults any person who relies on a guide, hearing or assistant dog, wheelchair or other remedial device is guilty of a crime and liable to 7 years imprisonment. So that upgrades it to a serious assault. Okay. Then you also have negligent act of causing harm and the duty of a person in charge of a dangerous thing and a duty of a person doing dangerous acts. Now, they're very, very important. And the other one that's a criminal issue, believe it or not, is a common nuisance. And I'll just read this to you. Any person, this is section 230 of the Criminal Code. Now, this is in Queensland, so you know it all depends on which state or country you come from. But any person who, without lawful justification or excuse, okay, by which act or omission danger is caused to the lives, safety, or health of the public, or without lawful justification or excuse, the proof of which lies in the person, does any act or omits to do any act with respect to any property under the person's control by which act or omission danger is caused to the property or comfort of the public, or the public are obstructed in the exercise of or enjoyment of any right common to Her Majesty's subjects. Remember I talked about I have the right to the quiet enjoyment of my land? That's what that's covering. By which injury is caused to the person of some person is liable to imprisonment for 2 years. Okay?
Wow. That's significant in and of itself. So with these, you've quoted case law, and it's specifically applicable to Queensland, Australia. Some of it's applicable internationally and everywhere, but I just want to ask specifically, it's up to the individual and or their lawyer to identify which of this and identify the how, you know, quote the laws and quote the case laws applicable to their region, correct? So don't just take this and copy it because it says Queensland.
Yeah, that's correct. And number 22, and this is important, okay? Commencing legal action can be a complicated process. It has many pitfalls and can be a costly exercise, especially if you don't win your case. It is highly recommended that you seek legal advice to clarify your options and position before you take any steps and or proceed to a court of law, okay? So that's just sort of a very basic step-by-step process, and I gave a very basic understanding of some of the civil liability. So in essence, it's sort of got some of my advice, what I would sort of advise in some way in here, but it doesn't really cover a full-on legal advice, but at least that's enough to help you out or help somebody out, yeah.
Excellent. Ray, this is incredibly valuable. And thank you so much for taking the time to walk everyone through this. Now, we're going to be making all of these documents available on the website that's linked on this page that Ray's talk is embedded on. And so they will be providing, that website will be providing sort of first line support, but please, please consider a contribution to that website, on that website, as Ray has mentioned, and we've talked about here a couple times. That is going to help to continue to, you know, the more resources we have to put behind this, you know, the more resources that go to the people that are doing this work on the ground, the bigger this thing can go, the more people can be put on it. So I just want to encourage everyone, as they go to the website and download their documents, download this 22-step guide and the document templates, please do consider that. Ray, just wrapping up here, any final thoughts for our audience?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly read the very first paragraph on this warning and objection notice. So,
please.
This is to the emitters, to the council, to everybody.
Okay.
So take notice that the warnings and objection contained in this notice is intended not only to protect myself, my family, and my property, but is intended to also protect you and to warn you of your duty of care and to warn you of the possible consequences that any of your actions or emissions in regards to the emission of any non-ionizing electromagnetic radiation onto my land from your facility and situated that is either in your possession, charge, and or directly under your control or under your management, that failure to heed this notice has the potential to place you in jeopardy of being both criminally and civilly liable for any actions or omissions that cause harm, injury, and damage. So that's basically part of the notice itself. And that's about it, really. And I just wish everybody good luck. And you know, the more lawyers we can get involved in this, the better. And hopefully, I can't guarantee that this will work for you or for your listeners, but I've had some success with it. I'm not saying that I've been successful everywhere, but I've had success with it nevertheless, and just wish everyone good luck, and may everybody be empowered, I guess. Thanks for everything you do too, by the way, Josh. Wonderful. Thank you.